So welcome back to our third of the Neuromuscular Neurology podcasts.
Hopefully final.
Hopefully final. Well, maybe not ever. If you remember in part one, we talked about disorders of the motor neuron, the plexuses, brachial and lumbosacral plexuses. We talked about neuropathies. In the second part, we talked about disorders of the neuromuscular junction, and we spent a ton of time talking about the broad range of disorders involved in dysfunction of the muscle. For this podcast, we're going to talk about EMG and nerve conduction studies and just review some of the basics of findings on EMG and nerve conduction studies. And then we're going to move on to focal neuropathies. And we're going to walk through the commonest focal neuropathies and focus on a specific set of nerves. So I'm going to welcome back Jeff Dewey. Jeff, thanks for coming.
Thank you.
So Jeff, let's talk through the EMG study. So we sort of casually call this EMG, but it does have multiple parts. Can you speak to the parts of the study and how they play out?
I think a lot of times when we say EMG, what we really mean is NCS, and that's nerve conduction study. That's the electrical portion of the EMG NCS test. And it's best for assessing neuropathies and to a much lesser degree myopathies. So it works by stimulating either the motor or sensory nerves and recording the response from either the muscle or a more distal portion of the sensory nerve, respectively. The main things to know for exam purposes are that we're really looking at a couple of parameters. One is the velocity, and that's measured as conduction velocity. Sometimes it's also measured as latency, which, depending on the type of study, is a little bit less accurate. But either of those indicate the health of the myelin. And then there's the amplitude of either the snap or the CMAP, which is the sensory nerve action potential or motor nerve action potential. And that amplitude tells you about the health of the axon.
So for very basic purposes, if you're thinking of disorders of the nerve, so if you see decreased amplitudes out of proportion to decreased conduction velocities and latencies, you're thinking about an axonal process. If you see prolonged distal latencies and decreased conduction velocities, you're thinking about demyelinating processes with less of a component of axonal damage. And of course, you can see mixed pictures.
Absolutely. And I think there's one place where this becomes a little confusing, and that's conduction block. So conduction block is when you see a marked decrease in amplitude of a motor potential as you work proximally up an extremity. So you'll perhaps stimulate at the wrist and see one amplitude and then stimulate at the elbow and see one that's, we technically say less than 50% of the more distal stimulation. So this initially could look like an axonal process, but what it actually tells us is that there's a focal or multifocal demyelination in between the two stimulation points. So despite being a decreased amplitude, because it's a relative decreased amplitude from two spots, it's actually a demyelinating process.
And I guess the clue is that if you stimulate distally along a nerve and you get a normal CMAP amplitude, that tells you that there has to be adequate integrity of the axons. And then you stimulate more proximally, so closer to the origin of the nerve, and you get less of a stimulation. Really, the only thing left is focal severe demyelination.
And for exam purposes, you'll only see this on a motor study.
So tell us a little bit about the components of the needle examination and how those can be helpful.
So it's a supplement to the nerve conduction study, and they really complement each other. It only tells us about motor nerves. So we're listening to different muscles, and you choose the muscle based on the pathology you're looking for. And then there are two phases to each muscle. So one is the spontaneous activity. That's when the needle's inserted and the muscle is entirely relaxed. And ideally, a muscle's silent. If you see spontaneous activity of any kind, odds are it's going to be a sign of nerve dysfunction at some point in the motor nerve. Now, you can see it with a myositis as well, and that's where it gets a little bit confusing. But then you can sort that out with the second phase of the study, and that's the volitional or recruitment phase. And that's when you ask the patient to activate the muscle that you're listening to. And you're looking at not only the shape of the motor unit action potential, the MUAP, but also the pattern in which they recruit various motor units, both how quickly that happens and then the amplitude you get from those motor units.
And my understanding is that the size and morphology of those motor unit action potentials can give you a clue as to the underlying process.
So a quick rule of thumb is big, broad, long, and polyphasic potentials are neurogenic, and short, both in amplitude and duration, potentials are myopathic.
All right, I think we'll leave it at that. There are lots of different types of spontaneous activity that can give us clues as to different disorders, but we'll probably leave that for another time and maybe future sessions. Let's move on to focal neuropathies. Jeff, I did want to reiterate something you said in the previous podcast, in our first podcast, which is that the brachial plexus can be a challenge, but it is something that you can learn through repetition. You can learn to draw the brachial plexus and keep straight all of the components. And you had advised our residents to actually take the time at the start of any examination to draw the brachial plexus, draw where the nerves go. And this may help in terms of sorting out later on when you come upon a question and you don't feel lost and caught off guard.
Easier to do it when it's fresh in your mind.
So we would recommend to our listeners to really practice drawing the brachial plexus early and often throughout your training. But then before an exam, a good exam-taking skill is to practice the night before a handful of times, feel like you've got that down, get up the next morning, draw it again, and when you sit down at the test, just draw the brachial plexus. Draw those nerve roots, draw where they branch, and draw the final five nerves that end up in the arm and understand where they come from. And that's going to help you sort out those questions about brachial plexus anatomy when they come up on the exam. We're not going to talk about brachial plexus syndromes because we did talk a little bit about some of the etiological categories of plexopathies in our previous podcast. I'm going to move on to the median nerve. And I think disorders of the median nerve are among the most commonly seen in the clinical setting. The median nerve is derived from a number of different nerve roots based on how it comes through the brachial plexus and actually has innervation from all five of the nerve roots that come through the brachial plexus. The median nerve travels along the medial anterior aspect of the humerus and then goes along the anterior aspect of the lower arm. It gives mainly motor branches in the forearm and then, of course, the famous sensory branches in the hand. And it has one major branch that we're going to talk about independently, which is a pure motor branch, and that is the anterior interosseous nerve. And the way to remember that the anterior interosseous nerve is a branch of the median nerve is that the median nerve runs along the anterior aspect of the forearm when the hand is in the anatomical position. So, Jeff, can you talk a little bit about the common disorders we see in the median nerve? And maybe we'll start first with carpal tunnel syndrome.
So, yeah, that's actually one of the most common neurologic disorders, period. So carpal tunnel syndrome is really a clinical syndrome, but the underlying pathophysiology is a median neuropathy at the wrist, and particularly in the carpal tunnel where it travels with the finger flexor tendons in a very tight anatomic space underneath the flexor retinaculum that goes across the anterior surface of the palm. So carpal tunnel syndrome clinically is a syndrome of some combination of pain, numbness, paresthesias, or weakness affecting the lateral aspect of the hand when you're in anatomic position. And sensory-wise, you really think about it affecting the first three digits, the thumb, index, and middle finger, and often it's described as innervating the lateral half of the fourth digit or the ring finger as well.
In terms of clinical diagnosis, we have a few tests that can be helpful. Tinel's sign at the wrist, percussing the median nerve as it travels through the carpal tunnel. Phalen's sign, which is holding the hands flexed out, or the wrists flexed out in front of you for a period of time to see if this reproduces the sensory symptoms. And I've often heard of the Flick sign, and that is a symptom more than a sign, and that many patients will describe nocturnal symptoms. Nocturnal symptoms are really common with carpal tunnel syndrome, and people will describe having to flick their hands in front of them with their wrists flexed, or often hang their arm over the edge of the bed to allow those symptoms to resolve. And so nocturnal symptoms is one of the really helpful things with carpal tunnel syndrome. And what are the muscles that are innervated by the median nerve, and how can you tell if something's median neuropathy sort of more proximally versus more distally, and especially focusing on things that tend to come up on examinations?
So the muscles in the hand that are innervated all are in the lateral anterior aspect of the hand. So there are the muscles in the thenar eminence. That's the abductor pollicis brevis, the flexor pollicis brevis, which is actually dual innervated by the ulnar nerve as well, the opponens pollicis, and then you have the lumbricals to the first and second digits. So really what you see in these cases is atrophy of the thenar eminence, that meaty part of the palm just proximal to the thumb. In terms of sensory distribution, I think this is critically important. There's a palmar cutaneous branch that dives, that does not dive under the flexor retinaculum. It actually comes off above it, and so it does not travel into the palm through the carpal tunnel. So when it's true carpal tunnel syndrome, the skin over the thenar eminence is actually generally spared. If that's involved, then you should be suspicious of a more proximal mediated neuropathy before that palmar cutaneous branches off.
And I think this is an extremely important point and something that comes up when we teach residents and medical students, and especially it's something that I've seen so many times in teaching PGY2s. We'll see a hospitalized patient with some finger flexor weakness, and of course some of the finger flexors are important in are innervated by the median nerve, but of course that can't possibly be carpal tunnel syndrome because the innervation of the finger flexors is much more proximal than at the wrist. Can you tell us about electrodiagnostic testing of carpal tunnel syndrome?
So it's mainly diagnosed by nerve conduction study. And what you're looking for is in early syndromes, you'll see a demyelinating change on your nerve conduction study. So that's, again, slowing of sensory and or motor potentials across the palm. So when you stimulate in the forearm, even distal forearm, you should see some slowing. Often electrophysiologists will stimulate in the palm as well. And really what that can help you do is see conduction block. So you'll see a normal motor response when stimulating in the palm, but that's markedly decreased when stimulating more proximally, either at the wrist or further up in the forearm. On a needle examination, the easiest muscle to access with a needle is the abductor pollicis brevis, and there you may see some of those neurogenic changes that we talked about earlier.
And my understanding is that it's usually sensory abnormalities first on the nerve conduction studies. More advanced cases, you're going to see some motor abnormalities, and really it has to be fairly severe carpal tunnel syndrome or median neuropathy at the wrist to see any changes on needle EMG.
Correct, and that goes for axonal changes in terms of decreased amplitudes in the motor study as well. You do see decreased sensory amplitudes pretty early on.
It is important to remember some of the syndromes that put you at risk of carpal tunnel syndrome, and these tend to be syndromes that put you at risk of a lot of the compressive neuropathies. I always remember that any disorder that can give you a polyneuropathy can give you focal compressive neuropathies as well, so commonly associated with diabetes, for example. We can see it in pregnancy, very common complication in pregnancy. You can see it in amyloidosis and multiple myeloma, which can be disorders, as we talked about, that can contribute to polyneuropathy as well. In people that are undergoing dialysis, again, somebody who can have neuropathy as well. Of course, it's important to remember as something that could be possible in primarily neurological syndromes. And just to repeat what we had talked about earlier, HNPP, so hereditary neuropathy with liability to pressure palsies, a place that you get pressure palsies is in the carpal tunnel. And carpal tunnel syndrome is a type of pressure palsy.
Can you remind us what the mutation is?
So HNPP is related to dysfunction of PMP22, so peripheral myelin protein 22. And I always remember that it's a deletion because this is an uncommon disorder. So I always think small, uncommon, and therefore deletion. And it can be in a number of different regions, but it tends to be a deletion.
And I want to add one other sort of masquerading syndrome on there, which is multifocal motor neuropathy. So this is a demyelinating disorder, and in patients who are at risk for demyelination, places like the carpal tunnel are places where this could happen first. What should clue you in that it's not carpal tunnel is there should not be any sensory changes.
So an important element, some key points to remember, carpal tunnel syndrome is related to compression of the median nerve through the carpal tunnel. There is sensory changes that should spare the thenar eminence because the sensory innervation of the thenar eminence actually has an origin above the carpal tunnel. That the weakness really should be in the muscles that of the intrinsic hand muscles that are innervated by the median nerve. And as you said, the biggest of those is the abductor pollicis brevis, part of the flexor pollicis muscle as well, which is partially innervated by the ulnar nerve as well, the opponens in pollicis, and the first and second lumbricals. Is that right?
That's correct.
On EMG study, this is usually a focal demyelination syndrome, so you can see evidence of prolonged distal latency. In more severe cases, you can see evidence of conduction block across the wrist. Later on, you can see motor demyelination or even decreased CMAP amplitudes if it's very severe. And then in more severe cases, if there's axonal damage, you can see abnormalities on EMG. But that would be in relatively advanced disease. And I suspect that you'd probably see signs of clinical weakness if you're going to see findings on needle EMG.
And certainly some atrophy as well.
I want to talk about the anterior interosseous nerve. So the anterior interosseous nerve is a more proximal branch of the median nerve. It's a pure motor branch. It's called the anterior interosseous because it falls in the anterior aspect of the forearm in the anatomical position. It runs between two bones, the radius and ulnar, and that's the reason it's called the interosseous nerve, I think. The anterior interosseous nerve branches just distal to the branch for the flexor digitorum superficialis, so for the flexors that are important for flexion around the proximal IP joint. The interosseous nerve contains the flexor muscles for the index and middle fingers, which are called the flexor digitorum profundus for digit 1 and 2, and those are the flexors around the distal IP joints. The flexor pollicis longus, which is a thumb flexor muscle, and one of the pronators, the pronator quadratus. And so the characteristic clinical sign that you're going to see with an anterior interosseous neuropathy is difficulty with distal flexion of the fingers and thumb.
Mm-hmm.
So, Jeff, this is something that shows up on exams and actually something that comes up clinically. We talked about the weakness, which tends to be in those finger and thumb flexors, and a little bit of pronation weakness. And this syndrome seems to be related to focal compression. Can you talk a little bit more about where you might see an interosseous neuropathy?
So this typically happens around the elbow as the nerve dives deep into the forearm. You see this a lot in patients who excessively pronate their arms or do lifting that really bulks up the forearms. I like to think about it as rock climbers or muscle men who do a lot of flexing of their elbows in the pronated position. The main things you'll see on exam are, as you said, some weakness of the distal finger flexors and the index and middle fingers. You can also see some weakness of pronation, even though you have two muscles that subserve pronation of the arm, only one of which is addressed by the anterior interosseous. The EMG diagnosis is much easier because all you have to do is sample one of the muscles that's subserved by the anterior interosseous nerve. The pronator quadratus is probably the most easily accessible.
And I think I mentioned this on a previous podcast, but there is some association between Parsonage-Turner syndrome and isolated anterior interosseous neuropathy. So there are people with Parsonage-Turner syndrome who will have an element of a fairly focal isolated interosseous neuropathy, which can be seen on EMG and which you can break apart from the other nerves.
And I think the thing to remember is that this is separate from the nerve to the intrinsic hand muscles. So the distal median muscles should be spared, all of the thenar muscles, despite this finger 1 and 2 weakness.
And then moving a little more proximally in the median nerve, there are four branches that we didn't talk about yet that come off just above the branch to the anterior interosseous and then the more distal muscles. And this can be a clue that somebody has a median neuropathy at or above the elbow. And mm-hmm. Some common causes of median neuropathy at or above the elbow could include trauma, could include fractures. We sometimes see this with people who have had an anastomosis for dialysis, and they have an ischemia or hemorrhage compressing the proximal median nerve.
And post-traumatic tourniqueting is actually a fairly common reason, too, if someone suffers a large laceration in the arm and needs a tourniquet for a period of time.
So the clues that somebody has a very proximal median neuropathy is that they're going to have a lot of weakness in not only their finger flexors and the thenar muscles, but also the wrist flexors.
Correct.
And they'll probably have a very severe element of weakness of pronation as well. So the four branches of the proximal median nerve are the pronator teres, the flexor carpi radialis, which is one of the big wrist flexors on the radial side, the palmaris longus, and the flexor digitorum superficialis, which are the flexors that really innervate the muscles that flex the fingers on the proximal IP joints. So I just want to summarize the median nerve from proximal to distal. We talked about the very proximal motor branches, which, as I said, are going to be your wrist and proximal finger flexors. The anterior interosseous nerve, which will give you your distal finger flexors and thumb flexor. And then the distal motor branch, which actually branches off after the nerve, goes through the carpal tunnel. And that will mainly innervate the thenar muscles and some of the thumb flexors and opposition muscles. And then, of course, there is a both a proximal and distal sensory branch. The proximal branch is above the carpal tunnel, and that's going to be over the thenar eminence. And then distal to the carpal tunnel is going to be in your classic carpal tunnel syndrome distribution, which will be the thumb and first two digits and the lateral aspect of your ring finger. So I think we've covered sort of the common things in median neuropathy. I think it's good to be aware of very proximal median nerves. It's good to be aware of interosseous neuropathy. And you can delve into more of that as we move on. Let's move on to the ulnar nerve. So ulnar neuropathies are really common as well. And shall we walk down the ulnar nerve and talk about the motor and sensory branches?
So the ulnar nerve, most of its motor is really in the intrinsic hand muscles. It has two functions above the wrist. So it's the flexor carpi ulnaris, which is the other wrist flexor, and sort of makes up some of the bulk of the medial forearm. And then the other two FDPs, or flexor digitorum profundi, which they're labeled 3 and 4, but they do the analogous function to the median innervated muscles, which is flex the distal interphalangeal joints. The way I remember the ulnar hand muscles is it's everything the median nerve is not. So if you know the few muscles that are innervated by the median nerve, then you can just assume that everything else is innervated by the ulnar nerve. And that goes all the way from probably the most medial in anatomic position is the abductor digiti minimi, and the most lateral would be the first dorsal interosseous, which is that posterior hand muscle that forms a muscle bulk between the thumb and index finger.
I often think about when assessing for muscle wasting in the motor nerve, if you look over the dorsal aspect of the hand, you'll see atrophy and you'll see prominence of the metacarpal joint or the metacarpal bone coming to the index finger, and you'll often see atrophy of the hypothenar eminence.
I think you once described Froment's sign, which is the inability to pinch a piece of paper between the thumb and index finger due to FDI weakness.
Absolutely. So it's one of a few signs named after Froment, but basically you take a piece of paper and you put it between the thumb and the index finger and pull, and people will not be able to hold it there, or they will compensate by activating median innervated muscles. So they'll activate the flexor pollicis, which is a median innervated muscle, to push against, rather than using the adductor pollicis, rather than using the adduction of the thumb. Let's walk through the most common causes of ulnar neuropathy. So, Jeff, tell me about probably the most common type of ulnar neuropathy.
I think the one we see most often is cubital tunnel syndrome, or ulnar nerve entrapment in the cubital tunnel, which is at the elbow, the medial aspect of the elbow. And this is where we commonly think of the funny bone, which is really just a brief ulnar nerve pain when you get hit there. These are people who bend and flex their elbows a lot, or tend to rest their elbows on things either out of hobbies or habit or even due to work. People who drive and rest their arms on center consoles or windows. And these people will describe typically a numbness as the first symptom in the ulnar innervation of the hand. So that's the fifth digit, the pinky, and then the medial half of the ring finger. If it's really at the elbow, then it's going to affect the entire palmar and a dorsal aspect of the hand in that sort of segment of the hand. They may also have some weakness of wrist flexion, and that's coming from flexor carpi ulnaris weakness. And then, of course, weakness in the intrinsic hand muscles can be seen.
And this is another place where on EMG you're going to see conduction block in a lot of cases. Yep, so can you talk us through that?
Yeah, the first clue will be a slowing of conduction velocity, usually motor conduction velocity, across the elbow. So you'll see stimulation. We typically stimulate the ulnar nerve in 3 points in order to pick this up. So one is at the wrist, one is at the proximal forearm, and then one is at the distal upper arm, so below and above the elbow. And you'll see an isolated slow conduction velocity there with a normal conduction velocity more distal in the arm. As things progress, you can get distal axonal changes, so decreased sensory amplitudes. But it's important to note that the sensory velocities across the wrist are normal. So the myelin there is not affected. This is a focal myelin problem. And then, of course, later on, you can see decreased motor amplitudes as well.
So the keys to diagnosing an ulnar neuropathy at the elbow are to look for evidence of conduction block across the elbow. So an evidence of decrease in CMAP amplitude when stimulating above the elbow compared to when stimulating below, or a decrease in conduction velocity, again, above the elbow compared to below. I remember somewhere hearing about a phenomenon called inching, and this is to look for focal conduction block when it is crossing areas that are not necessarily anatomically bounded, so maybe in non-compression neuropathies. I thought it might be useful to talk about that now.
Yeah, it's the nice thing is the name is pretty literal. So all we do is we record our muscle action potential at a muscle of choice, and then we inch our way more proximally along the course of the nerve. And the idea is that you can find a point within about an inch or so of where you develop conduction block, and that tells you where your block is. People will use this for carpal tunnel syndrome or cubital tunnel syndrome as well. It can really show you more precisely where any conduction block might be.
What about ulnar neuropathies at the wrist, Jeff?
So this is sometimes called Guyon's canal syndrome. Anatomically, it's fairly analogous to carpal tunnel syndrome. So there's a canal a little more medially where the ulnar nerve passes through. It's not accompanied by nearly as many tendons, but it still is susceptible to compression and often accompanies carpal tunnel syndrome, albeit in a milder form, because the same repetitive motions and wrist compression put patients at risk for both. The thing that will distinguish it from ulnar neuropathy at the elbow is really the EMG. So this is, or the nerve conduction study, this is where you will see slowing across the wrist, because this is the area where the demyelination is happening, but the velocity across the elbow will be normal. The other thing that distinguishes the two is you should never see any changes in the dorsal ulnar cutaneous branch. So there's a branch of the ulnar nerve that branches off above the wrist and goes around to the back side of the hand. And that should be entirely spared in any pathology in Guyon's canal.
One other thing, of course, is to think about the muscles that innervated, and this is going back to the median neuropathy issue. If, as you said, there are a couple of finger flexors, those distal finger flexors that are important in ulnar nerve for the ring and pinky finger, and those should not be weak in an ulnar neuropathy at the wrist.
Yeah, I like to have a couple of deal breakers, I call them, for each condition. So for localizing an ulnar neuropathy, involvement of the flexor carpi ulnaris is a deal breaker. If that's involved, then it has to be at the elbow. And if it's not involved and the hand muscles are, then it has to be distal.
And then I remember even more distally, you can get compression of the ulnar nerve in the hand. And I remember a syndrome called cyclist hand or cyclist syndrome. And apparently this has to do with prolonged compression of the pure motor branch of the ulnar nerve in the palm of the hand. And this can lead to very focal intrinsic hand muscle weakness, which should occur in the absence of any numbness, because usually it's a little more distal to where the sensory branch comes. And so you see this weakness and wasting in muscles like the first dorsal interosseous muscle, for example, but no weakness more proximally and no numbness. And I've had a couple of patients who are these long-distance cyclists, and long-distance cyclists can do it. I think it was described in the past with people who were building things or working in industry and would be hammering something with the palm of their hand repetitively. And again, it's just good to remember that those intrinsic hand muscles, those interossei muscles, are innervated by a very distal motor branch of the hand and can be compressed, but you shouldn't see that classic ulnar sensory finding if it's in the hand.
Great.
So a nice little clinical pearl. I'm not sure how much that comes up on exam, but we see these referrals, and just in terms of history, if you hear about a cyclist, you might be thinking about a very distal ulnar neuropathy. So just to summarize, the ulnar nerve has both sensory and motor branches. The proximal branches of the ulnar nerve in the forearm are the flexor carpi ulnaris. This is the flexor of the wrist on the ulnar side. And the flexor digitorum profundus 3 and 4, which are the ones that flex around the distal IP joint of the ring and pinky finger. Then, of course, there's both a proximal and distal sensory branch. The proximal branch really innervates the dorsal aspect of the hand, and the more distal branch after Guyon's canal innervates the fingers, and that's the pinky finger and the medial aspect of the ring finger. And then there's a number of intrinsic hand muscles. Most common abnormality of the ulnar nerve is at the elbow, compression at the elbow, and you should see conduction block around the elbow if you're looking for an ulnar neuropathy at the elbow, but you can also see Guyon's canal syndrome and then the cyclist hand, which has to do with very distal motor branches. So that's a summary of the ulnar neuropathies. Why don't we move on to the radial neuropathy?
So the radial nerve really innervates all the muscles in the distal arm that we haven't talked about yet. And primarily, these are the extensor muscles of the fingers and the wrist, and all are on the dorsal aspect of the forearm for the most part. The radial nerve travels down along the biceps, and this is important to know, along the humerus, and this is important to know because it's probably the most likely site of injury, which is in the spiral groove of the humerus. Oftentimes, a clinical vignette might be a patient who suffered a humeral fracture during a trauma and then has a wrist drop. And this is a pretty typical story for radial neuropathy. The important things to know anatomically are that the triceps muscles are innervated proximal to the spiral groove. And so those are really sort of your deal breakers on localizing any radial neuropathy is whether or not the triceps are involved. The rest of the radial muscles really only exist down to about the mid-forearm. And after that, the radial nerve has only a sensory branch that's traveling down to the hand.
And that sensory branch of the radial nerve is relatively small. It's really around the anatomical snuff box. Mm-hmm. It's sort of just between the thumb and the forefinger on the posterior aspect of the hand.
With a large amount of overlap with median and ulnar territories as well.
And then, so we talked about that wrist drop that can be related to compression around the humerus. This is sometimes called Saturday night palsy.
Yep, and that actually is, in Saturday night palsy, you'll often see an extensor weakness. Typically because that tends to occur a little bit higher on the nerve, but I think that's sort of a plus minus. It really depends on what part of the arm you fell asleep with resting on your chair on Saturday night.
So the key is that the radial nerve innervates those fingers and wrist extensors, but there is also innervation of the triceps muscles. But the branches of the triceps muscles come off just before the spiral groove. So whether or not there is triceps weakness is really going to tell you whether or not the compression or disorder is above or below the spiral groove. The radial nerve goes along the posterior aspect of the forearm as it innervates the extensor muscles. And I think this is really important because there is the syndrome of posterior interosseous neuropathy. So similar to the median nerve having those anterior interosseous neuropathies or anterosseous nerve, there is a posterior interosseous nerve, which again, I think is a pure motor branch. And can you run through the muscles that are involved in the PIN?
Yeah, so first of all, you rightly pointed out that both of the interosseous syndromes are pure motor syndromes because these are pure motor nerves. So there are quite a few nerves that are subserved by the posterior interosseous branch, but they're really all of the things that extend the wrist and the fingers and thumb. It's probably easier to know the muscles that are proximal, which is the brachioradialis, and that flexes the forearm in sort of a mid-pronated position, or flexes the elbow, and then, of course, the triceps and everything above. There is a wrist extensor that is above and sort of at the branch point of the posterior interosseous. So even in a posterior interosseous syndrome, you may retain some wrist extension, but all finger and thumb extension should be completely affected.
And my memory is that a posterior interosseous neuropathy, one of the clues is that you have finger drop without as much severe wrist drop as you see with a more proximal radial neuropathy.
Exactly.
So that isolated finger drop because of weakness of those finger extensors is really a huge clue that something is a posterior interosseous neuropathy. And what are some of the causes of posterior interosseous neuropathies?
So in general, I would say that you want to look for a story of traumatic injury to the forearm and something affecting the posterior compartment in the proximal forearm. There are idiopathic cases as well, but of course these are diagnoses of exclusion.
So the other two nerves in the arm are the musculocutaneous nerve, which mainly innervates the biceps muscles and elbow flexors, and then the axillary nerve. Jeff, do you want to speak to any clinical pearls about axillary neuropathy?
I think just the one to know is that it innervates shoulder abduction. But does not innervate the supraspinatus, so it doesn't mean that you'll have a totally weak shoulder. But there's a very small patch of skin on the outer aspect of the shoulder that gets sensory innervation from the axillary nerve. And I think that would be a good important buzzword to remember.
This is not an exhaustive list of the focal neuropathies, but some of the common ones to bone up on. And we'll supplement this with additional podcasts. But Jeff, do you want to talk a little bit about the common peroneal nerve and peroneal neuropathy?
Yes, this is probably the most common focal neuropathy in the leg. It's because of the vulnerability of the common peroneal nerve as it travels, behind the fibular head. So the peroneal nerve is a branch of the sciatic nerve, and it actually travels probably topographically isolated within the sciatic nerve. On its way down the leg, it gives off one branch to the short head of the biceps femoris, and we'll talk about why this is important in a minute, before it travels into the posterior knee and then branches down into the common peroneal nerve. The common peroneal nerve has deep and superficial branches. The deep branch innervates the tibialis anterior in terms of the lower leg, and then the superficial branch innervates the peroneus longus and brevis. The deep peroneal nerve also goes on to innervate the extensor digitorum brevis, whereas the superficial peroneal nerve goes on to innervate the skin on the top of the foot.
So this is really important. Peroneal neuropathy will typically present with a foot drop because all of the muscles that you're talking about are really ankle dorsiflexors and then toe extensors. The most common lesion or cause of a peroneal neuropathy tends to be focal compression at or around the fibular head. And do you want to speak again to how this is important and how we sort this out clinically and electrodiagnostically?
The typical story is of a patient with a foot drop, but this is not a very specific condition for a common peroneal neuropathy. The thing to remember, again, is this short head of the biceps femoris. So this, again, muscle is innervated prior to the common peroneal nerve passing around the fibular head. So far and away, the most common place for compressive neuropathy in the peroneal nerve is at the fibular head, meaning that everything distal to that would be affected. The muscle you want to pay attention to on the EMG is the short head of the biceps femoris. If this is spared, then that confirms a localization distal to that muscle, whereas if it's involved, then it's at least a more proximal sciatic neuropathy.
So a clinical syndrome of a foot drop on needle EMG, if you're suspicious about compression at the fibular head, there should be a normal EMG study of the short head of the biceps femoris. So there should be normal EMG study of the short head of the biceps femoris and possible abnormalities distal to that. And of course, as we talked about earlier on nerve conduction studies, you might see evidence of conduction block at or around the fibular head when you stimulate above and below the popliteal fossa.
And let's take a second and talk about the patient with foot drop, because this is a commonly tested subject due to its various possible underlying etiologies. So patients with foot drop really can have one of a handful of pathologies. One would be a peroneal neuropathy, an isolated peroneal neuropathy. One would be a sciatic neuropathy, and then one would be an L4, L5 radiculopathy, and all of these can contribute. The key things you need to know are what are the other ankle muscles doing. So as a quick refresher, the other muscles in the lower leg that to know are probably the gastrocnemius and the tibialis posterior. So the gastrocnemius is tibial innervated, but it's a S1, S2 muscle. And so it's completely distinct from any L4, L5 innervated muscles. The tibialis posterior is also tibial innervated, but it's L4, 5 innervated. And so that gives you at least some look at the higher lumbosacral roots. If the patient's deficits are only in dorsiflexion and eversion, those are purely peroneal innervated muscles, but that tells you that all the tibial muscles are spared. So this must be a common peroneal neuropathy. If foot inversion is involved but not foot plantar flexion, then this tells you that part of the tibial nerve is spared, but the other part is not, because the tibialis posterior is affected. And the only thing these muscles have in common is the lower lumbar roots, the L5 lumbar root. If plantar flexion is also affected, so the ankle is weak in all directions, then this must be a sciatic neuropathy or a widespread multi-level lumbosacral radiculopathy, which is much less common.
So I think this is critically important. I think every neurologist needs to know about this, is the differential diagnosis of the foot drop. And the three main elements, as you said, Jeff, are a peroneal neuropathy, a L5 radiculopathy, or a more proximal sciatic neuropathy. In a peroneal neuropathy, you will have weakness of dorsiflexion, toe extension, and eversion, but you will have normal inversion and plantar flexion. If it's a L5 radiculopathy, you will have weakness of dorsiflexion, eversion, toe extension, and inversion, but you will have sparing of plantar flexion. If it's a sciatic neuropathy, then all of those muscles will be weak. The other clinical pearl I have is that there is a very proximal L5 innervated muscle, or at least has some L5 innervated input, and that is hip abduction. Mm. And that is from the superior gluteal nerve. So the superior gluteal nerve, which is a very proximal branch from the lumbosacral plexus that includes input from the L5 nerve root, is a hip abductor. And so if a patient has weakness of, has a foot drop and has weakness of both inversion, eversion, and dorsiflexion, but also has weakness of hip abduction, then that is another clue that this is probably an L5 radiculopathy. And you shouldn't see that with a sciatic neuropathy more distally. So just another good one to think about is that superior gluteal nerve and hip abduction as well. Do you want to talk really quickly about lateral femoral cutaneous neuropathy?
So this is probably the most likely tested femoral neuropathy, just because it's so common. It's also known as moralgia paresthetica. And this is compression of the lateral femoral cutaneous nerve, which is a branch of the femoral nerve. It branches off very early and dives under the inguinal ligament as it travels toward the anterolateral aspect of the thigh. Patients will complain of a numbness, tingling, or sometimes a hyperesthesia sensation on the outside of their thigh, and will say perhaps their clothes or bed sheets feel like sandpaper on their leg. Typical things that predispose people to this are anything that puts pressure across the inguinal ligament. So that's crossing your legs, wearing tight pants or belts, being overweight. Pregnancy can also do this. It's a self-limited condition. It can typically be diagnosed clinically without an EMG or nerve conduction study, and is treated supportively as it tends to resolve within a few weeks.
So just to summarize what we talked about already, we talked about drawing the brachial plexus. So it's really important that you draw the brachial plexus over and over again, and at the start of your examination, whatever exam you're taking, that you sit down and the first thing you do is draw the brachial plexus, and then you have that to review as you go through the examination, and it's not something that you have to come up with spontaneously. We talked about a number of different nerve syndromes, but just to remember, the median nerve is important for wrist and finger flexors and the thenar aspects of the thumb. The ulnar nerve is important for a lot of the finger abductors and more proximately has a couple of muscles involved. The radial nerve, which is really important for extensors, and we remember that the triceps is a branch above the spiral groove as opposed to below. In the leg, it's really important to remember the differential diagnosis of a foot drop, which includes sciatic neuropathy, peroneal neuropathy, and L5 radiculopathy, and being able to sort out the differences between those two. Remembering that the big motor branch of the peroneal nerve that is proximal to the fibular head is the short hip of the biceps femoris. And remembering about moralgia paresthetica and dysfunction of the lateral femoral cutaneous nerve. All right, thanks, Jeff.
Thanks again for having me. Looking forward to doing more of these in the future.